From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Out with the old, in with the new. Plenty of people are hoping that 2009 could give us some relief from high unemployment rates, the home foreclosure crisis, and the struggling auto business. And President George W. Bush is stepping out of the Oval Office as President-elect Barack Obama prepares for his inauguration. We'll talk to our reporters about what the coming months might bring economically and politically. With us on today's Reporters Roundtable, we've got Detroit Free Press columnist Rochelle Riley and Marcus Mabry. He's the international business editor for The New York Times. Hi, guys.
Hello. Hi.
So, Rochelle, let me start with you. You're in Michigan, where General Motors got a slice of the federal bailout package. GMAC is the division of GM that makes car loans, and without loans, most people can't afford cars. So GMAC is going to get $5 billion from the feds in exchange for preferred stock. So in the end, do you think that this is something that's really going to help consumers and families?
Well, our greatest hope is that it's not too little too late. I think that people have been so battered by the economy that you've got to get them over a fear of going into debt for any reason. There are a lot of people who would like to support the American automaker, not necessarily because of a great patriotic spirit, but because they don't want to see the industry fail and 3 million jobs go away. So I think that there will be a difference. I think there are people who are hoping for some type of bridge to help.
What do you think, Marcus, this whole issue of too little, too late?
Well, I think Rochelle's exactly right. I think she hit the nail on the head, because the problem is one of confidence here and consumer confidence. So we've had a kind of double-edged sword here that's cutting both ways against helping our economy recover from what we think, you know, could be the worst recession since the Great Depression. And on one side, you have the fact that people have not been able to get credit, even those who are worthy of credit, because credit markets are frozen up because of a crisis of confidence between and among financial institutions. On the other side of the problem, you have people who don't have the faith to go out and buy anything. And so the problem is, even though GMAC now is liquid and it has credit to lend, the problem is many Americans are not going to have faith that they're going to have their job tomorrow. If you don't think you're going to have your job tomorrow, then you're not going to go out and buy a huge ticket item like a car. And that's the basis of the problem. If that confidence is not restored in the consumers, then it doesn't matter that even GMAC has this money lent out, no one's going to go out and buy a car. And that without that happening, you're not going to have a restarting of this very deadly economy right now.
But Marcus, what do you see as the other options that economists have discussed? What other ways are people thinking about letting the auto industry recover?
Well, you know, a lot of people are saying that the problem is such a massive problem now, and it's such an interrelated problem. So on the one hand, you certainly start by the temporary bailouts of GMAC, of the auto companies themselves. I say temporary bailout because it's very likely that they will need from the incoming administration a further bailout. Politically, it's going to be interesting to see if the Republicans say, well, you know, this far, no further, so we won't support that. If that happens, then they could be right back where they were earlier, in 2008 when they were facing, you know, liquidation or at least bankruptcy, maybe a kind of canned bankruptcy. So that's the first problem. They're going to need more money, even with things going well, just because, again, you're not going to have consumer demand that you need to really, really put them on solid footing. That's not going to happen for a long time. So that brings us to the second point, which means the way you really help them in the end is by helping this economy. And so you give Americans, you give companies more faith that jobs are going to be there. You do that by hundreds of billion-dollar stimulus and potentially a trillion-dollar stimulus.
Rochelle, I want to turn to something closer to home, literally homes. You've got so many people, including a lot of folks in the Black community, working in the auto industry. And there are ripple effects that are seen in the housing market. So first of all, there's this report that measured the values of homes in October 2008 versus October 2007. They looked at 20 big metro areas, and the values of the homes dropped 18% in a year across this spectrum. And according to the survey, homes in Detroit are now worth less than they were 10 years ago. So how are people in Michigan reacting to that kind of news?
Well, you can imagine it's the same type of horror as worrying about whether you'll have a job coming in the next week. You've got people who not only have lost a fifth of the value of their home, but more importantly, their home is not worth what they still have to pay for it at a time when they may not be able to meet the mortgage at all. So we've got foreclosures that are skyrocketing, and Detroit is one of the leading cities. I think we were the leading city in the country on foreclosures. So it's a very difficult and unfortunate balancing act that right now is not balancing. And I think it's going to get worse before it gets better, which is why, as Marcus said, we've got to have that stimulus package and fast.
I'm going to ask you the same question, essentially, Marcus, for housing. What are some of the other options, you know, besides, for example, some of the ones that have been put on the table about lowering interest rates? Some people have said lower principal. Some people have said give cash payments to homeowners. What kinds of things are being put on the table that might help homeowners, and how likely are they to happen?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it's going to really depend on what this new team of the new administration does, and particularly on what Tim Geithner does coming in as Treasury Secretary, what he backs. He was, of course, someone who has studied under George W. Bush's last Treasury Secretary, Henry Paulson. But it's going to be interesting to see if he takes the same route or if he gets more aggressive. Right now, what the Obama administration is telling us is that they are going to be even more aggressive. So one of the things that they may do, for instance, is they may underwrite or they may even mandate, that's kind of heavy-handed, reordering of some of these loans that are outstanding. So, for instance, writing down principal, and this would be a tremendous hit to a banking sector, financial sector that still is reeling from its lack of confidence, but you could demand that they write down value of many homes to what they're worth today. Now, that would be, again, be we're talking hundreds of billions of dollars, potentially, again, trillions of dollars of lost value that they would have to take onto their books. That does not restore confidence to a banking sector that still is in trouble, and doesn't restore confidence amongst a part of international investors who have underwritten so much of our economy for so long. So it's kind of like a water balloon. You know, if you kind of put pressure on one side, then you make the bubble bulge out on the other side. It's no way to do this thing without someone getting hurt more.
When you look at 2008, Rochelle, and you look at the what is essentially the end of a presidential administration, how do you look ahead with the inauguration coming up? How do you look ahead to this transition? First of all, what do you think people will see as the legacy of President George W. Bush?
I think that what people have focused on is all of the things that he has done wrong. And his wife, his cabinet, people are trying to find some of the things that he has done right. And that would work at any other time except for this particular time in history when America is on such a downward spiral economically and defensively. And there are global issues that may not even wait for the transition and the inaugural. And I think that this was just the worst time in the world for a mediocre president. So I think that even those who were his supporters and backers and tried to find good things to say about him, some of those things are ringing hollow now, and I think the most they can say is that it is more than time for new leadership.
Marcus, you wrote a biography about Condoleezza Rice, one of the people who has been steadfast in her loyalty to the president. What kind of influence do you think she's having in the White House during the final days?
Well, you know, it's interesting for I because it makes me think when I heard the comments that Condi Rice made in support of this president saying, and she really did say, that people have not realized yet how much they're going to thank George Bush. They're going to actually look to him as someone who's liberated much of the world, certainly in Iraq and Afghanistan. And she really was speaking in almost Pollyannish terms, one could say. And when she did that, I immediately thought back to her stepmom, who she's very close to. Both of her natural parents have passed away. And to her dear friends, many of whom are staunch Democrats. And I remember how much they all told me how she had one of her faults was that she could be too loyal. and they really thought she had already been too loyal to this president during much of these 8 years. And I just thought when she said those comments, I thought, wow, they really must all be, you know, grinding their teeth right now and saying, you know, can't wait to get her back to California and straighten her out. but again, I think this has always been her role. She is the person who, even when she disagreed with a lot of what the administration was doing in the first term in terms of its foreign policy, when Donald Rumsfeld was Secretary of Defense and she was National Security Advisor, even then she would not talk publicly about her disagreements with Rumsfeld. And they were bitter, bitter disagreements. She says now she admits some of them, and she says, well, you know, we never took it personally. But, you know, professionally, it was not a coordinated foreign policy team. She bears some responsibility for that. And yet, in the second term, she tried to move this White House in a very different direction in foreign policy. So she's this amazing loyalist, and at the same time, she realizes in her heart of hearts some of the problems that they have. But I'm sure in these final days, what her job is is the same thing it's always been, to publicly speak very positively of this president, to always concentrate and emphasize the positive, even when there's very little of it that they can speak of after 8 years, and inside the White House to be, you know, one of the first best friend to him, right, and to Laura Bush.
So looking ahead from your angle, Rochelle, as you look to this inauguration, which first of all is predicted to be just this kind of enormous mass of people at the mall, the literal inauguration, but to the bigger issue of the transition of leadership, what do you see in that transition of leadership to a President Barack Obama?
Well, I don't want to oversell it because it's been oversold since the election. I will say that this is an inauguration for America, and that people around the world are looking for a different way of doing things, not only in the way we do business globally, but in the way we look globally. And I think that if there's going to be a change president, then President-elect Obama will have to do everything and more that he's promised.
Well, guys, it's been great talking to you. You take care.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We were speaking with Rochelle Riley, a columnist at the Detroit Free Press. She joined us from the University of Michigan studios in Ann Arbor, and Marcus Mabry, the international business editor for the New York Times. He's also the author of the book Twice as Good, Condoleezza Rice and Her Path to Power. He joined us from the NPR studios in New York. Next on News and Notes, two singer-songwriters, Shantae Moore and funkstress Nika Costa. Costa reveals what it takes to keep your own voice in the music industry and tells us how she produced her latest album, Pebble to a Pearl. Political art has been around for generations, but this election, it's got a new spin. Younger artists and designers have come out and remade or remixed images of Senator Barack Obama on posters, T-shirts, and billboards. Take Justin Bua. His fine art posters and illustrations show the beauty and struggle of life in the cities. His work is collected in a book called The Beat of Urban Art. He's also taken a foray into political illustration. Bua, it's great to have you here.
Great to be here.
So you're somebody who you can find your art in so many different places, on people's walls, on T-shirts. You know, you're someone who has kind of come up out of the 80s hip-hop scene and you know, made a life for yourself, not only as an artist, but an entrepreneur. A lot of times I end up describing things, but you in your book have this, you know, you have so many different illustrations, and I want you to describe one of them. So I wonder if you can crack open your own book and describe your piece Rising to us.
You know, Rising is really a painting about the rising above the insurmountable stigma of the projects. Mm-hmm. You know, really where onlookers sneer and there's a lot of player haters. You know, there's really only one way to rise above the stigma, and that is, in this case, through basketball. And that came from my experiences playing ball and hanging out at the Douglas and Dykeman projects and just, you know, knowing that a lot of these brothers thought that this was the only way out and the only way that they knew. You know, otherwise it was selling drugs or hustling.
So how did you choose to depict that?
You know, I showed it from an anti point of view, or a knock down on your butt perspective. I wanted to really show how dramatic it was and theatrical it was, and it is, you know, and playing ball in the projects is no joke because there's no rules.
This has this incredible sort of blue swirl in the middle that's actually mm-hmm. the it's the basketball pole, you know.
Yeah.
It's the you know, so that's something that really fascinated me, is that you take life and you bend it a little bit.
Well, you know, it's skewed, and I did a very classical S curve of the basket, which is a very Renaissance technique, and it all revolves around two C curves, which is an S curve. And then I saw it later on in a Michael Jordan commercial, and I was like, I know they bit my stuff because I came up with that first. So, and I also wanted to show, you know, that there were, you know, the city is very claustrophobic in terms of the undulating terracotta. It's everywhere. And I wanted to feel like it was closed in and there was only a sluice of sky that we could see because, you know, as a kid in New York, that's how sometimes you see the city. You know, you just see these gigantic architectural monuments, and then there's just a little bit of sky, which kind of in this case represents a little bit of hope.
All right. Well, speaking of hope, someone named Shepard Fairey did an Obama poster with the word hope at the bottom, and mm-hmm. it's become viral. But you've also got an Obama poster, and I want you to grab it off the table and describe for us what you see in your own work and how you chose to depict Barack Obama.
Well, you know, Shepard jumped on the train really early, you know, and it was really cool. And I think he inspired a lot of artists to kind of get involved. And Shepard was actually the one that asked me to be involved in the Manifest Hope Gallery that they were having in conjunction with the DNC.
Was an exhibit that was of different artists kind of doing this, different the visuals that related to Senator Obama and
that's
politics.
That's right. Different iterations and paintings of Senator Obama. Ron English did one of him as kind of morphing into Abe Lincoln. You know, Shepard's hope thing, you know, was enormous. You know, I did one of Obama looking obviously very hopeful into the city. He's behind him is a cityscape, and rising is the sun. I wanted it to be during, you know, the sunrise. And so he's being backlit by the sun in warm light. And the reason I did the city is because, you know, he's from the city. He can relate to the city. You know, he's raised by a single mom on food stamps, which is much like my experience growing up in Harlem. And, you know, I wrote one on it because he really represents one, you know, one global community, ethnically diverse, one nation, and really someone that we can, for the first time, being from urban life, relate to, besides Clinton, by the way.
Are you worried about there being an element of hero worship to this? I mean, both in the fact that so many artists are depicting him, but also in the way that he's depicted.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not worried about it. I think there is a lot of hero worship, but in contrast to what's out there, you know, he is a hero. You know, I think that I haven't been so inspired to do anything and get so involved since Clinton, you know, and I was working grassroots for that campaign. And for this, you know, I've always kept my work about hip-hop and jazz and the urban experience. My work is really about celebrating urban life, and to me, Obama represents that. He really does celebrate urban life, and he's someone that's very relatable.
You have this beautiful picture in your book about a jazz quartet or quintet.
Yeah.
Although you're dealing with a hip-hop sensibility, you also it's easy to see how it relates to a jazz and blues sensibility. Why did you do that work?
Well, you know, I think jazz is very much like hip-hop. It's very improvisational. Hip-hop is, you know, improvisational. They're both from the streets. You know, jazz originated on the streets. Hip-hop originated on the streets. So they both have the same origins. And, you know, people always ask me, why do you paint jazz? And simply I say the same thing, because it's cool. Why do you paint hip-hop? Because it's cool. You know, it has the savoir faire of the inner city. And that's what my work is really about.
When you think, and this is not an art question, when you think about some of the communities that you're depicting, some of the urban communities that where people may not be hopeful about either life or politics, do you think people are really going to turn out and vote? Do you think people are going to be able to transcend the disappointments of daily life and get themselves to the polls? Or do you think that they're still cynical, a lot of people?
Well, doing some grassroots passing out of my own poster, you know, I think that there are a lot of cynical people out there. But that being said, I think the reason that I did this is because I do sell more posters than any other living artist, and I did these posters, and I'm putting them out there for free for the people. And that I'm doing that because I have the expectation that people are actually going to come out and come to the polls, because the propaganda on MTV, I think a lot of those kids don't buy into it. They feel like, you know, MTV is just a machine, and certainly the slippery, serpentine, silver-tongued politicians they don't buy into. So I was hoping that, you know, by getting my work out there, that it would bring some kind of authenticity to that demo, the younger demo, you know, the 18 to 24-year-old kids who are like, okay, well, you know, Bua is representing, Bua supports him, maybe this is important, let me look into it more. Shepard Fairey supporting him, let me look into it more. So that, you know, people who don't feel like they can make a change are really out of their mind. You know, but you'd be surprised. I run into kids who are like, well, I'm an anarchist, man. You know what I mean? And I'm like, well, you're delusional. You really need to do something. Okay, stop getting high just for a little bit and go to the polls and vote.
Stay straight for 8 hours and go ahead and vote. All right, on that note, Bua, thanks so much.
All right. Thank you so much.
Justin Bua is an artist and illustrator. He is also the author of The Beat of Urban Art, and he was right here with me at our studios in Culver City, California. You can watch the video of this interview and find links to his images, his work, on our blog, nprnewsandviews.org. That's News and Notes. Nicole Childers and Christabel Nsiabwadi produce the show. Joanne Griffith, Anthea Raymond, and Sasha Woodruff edit. And Kenya Young is our director. Our technical director is Shireen Strausberg. Marcia Caldwell is our drive engineer. Our staff includes Tony Cox, Roy Hurst, Jeffrey Bennett, Jeffrey Gardner, Devin Robbins, Zachary Slobig, and Sonata Lee Narcisse. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. It's art school meets political boot camp. Images of Senator Barack Obama have been altered, remade, and plastered on walls, bumper stickers, and clothing. Of course, you can find them online as well. Barack Obama's image has become, for better or worse, an icon. For example, Los Angeles-based artist Shepard Fairey created an iconic poster of Obama's face with the word hope, rendered in red, white, and blue. In a few minutes, we're going to talk to two experts on the history of political images, but now we turn to the artist Shepard Fairey. How are you?
I'm great.
So how did this image get started? I mean, you're not someone who just came as a, you know, you didn't just breeze into doing graphic art. You've been doing it for years very successfully. But what about this image called to you?
Well, I've been making political graphics for a while, but most of them have been negative, especially criticizing the policies of the Bush administration. And I think for once, I was inspired to make a positive political graphic because I felt that Barack Obama was an unusual candidate, a special candidate, and that it was worth putting my efforts into making something positive, which is a bit of a departure for me. The image itself, I felt I should make something that portrayed Obama as having vision and the ability to lead, and that's very abstract, but I think you know it when you see it. So I looked for an image that I could illustrate from that I think portrayed those qualities. And I wanted to make this image actually very patriotic and reverent because I wanted it to pique the interest of people that maybe weren't converted already to his cause. And I think that most of my friends, the way my art usually leans, would have already been Obama supporters. So I actually made something that I felt was maybe going to transcend the counterculture.
When was the first moment that you knew that your art had gone viral?
Almost immediately, after I posted the initial graphic on my website, letting people know that I was going to create a screen-printed poster for sale, a lot of blogs and even news outlets picked up on it, which was surprising to me. I think that maybe that happened because I have a history of when I make an image, it ends up being put out there on the street and manifesting in various forms. So maybe there was a bit of an expectation. But I actually sold my initial run of posters for less than I sell my usual posters for, figuring that maybe a partisan image would have a lower demand. And immediately, not only did the image go viral, but it was being sold on eBay for between $1,000 and $5,000 when I sold the initial print run for $45 each. So it far exceeded my expectations for, just its resonance and its demand.
What you did seems, in a way, well-suited for grassroots campaigning. You know, people can take this image that you have, get a version of it that's online, print it out, take it and wave it around in the physical world, or they can attach it to a website. Do you ever feel that people have crossed a line with use of your image, though, that the way in which people have decided to replicate it or alter it is something that you've got to put a stop to, and can you put a stop to it?
Well, my objective in creating the image was just to make people curious about Obama. They would check him out further and see his merits the way I see them, hopefully. And I've put every dime that I've made from Obama posters and art back into either making more materials or donating to the campaign up to the legal limit. However, there are some people who are making bootlegs and they're just pocketing the money. And I try to spend my time doing positive things, but I don't think that's right. So I've tried to at least get the worst offenders selling shirts in airports and things like that and have them divert some of their profits back to the Obama campaign, not to me. But really what I think all the knockoffs, bootlegs, parodies say is how much the image has resonated and how much it's become a reference point, a symbolic reference point. So in that sense, I'm very happy that people care to riff off of it. And really all is forgiven if Obama gets elected.
Do you see yourself at this point as a surrogate for the campaign, having come from the background, like you said, of doing art that was much more antagonistic in your face? At this point, you have been referenced probably in as many campaign articles as, you know, any staffer on the Obama campaign itself. So do you see yourself as a kind of Obama surrogate?
Well, I do think that I'm fairly well educated about where Obama's coming from, all of his policy points, but I just consider myself an artist, and I would leave it up to the viewer, hopefully, to just be inspired by my image to go and find out more about Obama on their own. His website lays it out pretty clearly. I think my job is to create an image that has some heartfelt passion behind it that then the viewer says, okay, this image was obviously inspired. Let me see what inspired the person to create it. That's really my job, I think. If people want to ask me why I support Obama, I'm glad to let them know. But I think it says more about media culture than my qualification as a surrogate that I've gotten so much attention.
Well, Shepard, thank you.
Thank you.
That was the artist Shepard Fairey. He's the founder of Studio Number One, and that's a design company based in Los Angeles. When I think of love, what I first think of is how for granted we take. That's music from Shantae Moore's Love the Woman. It's her first solo CD in 8 years. She's been singing duets with her husband, Kenny Lattimore, and she's been focusing on gospel music. As Shantae will tell you, the church is in her blood. And that's the first thing NPR's Tony Cox asked her. How does she straddle the two worlds, religious and secular?
Because it's not two worlds to me. I don't even think about it like that. Keeping my integrity is what I think about it. You just do your job and you do it well, and you keep your integrity. And I don't sing anything I wouldn't be able to sing in front of my children. I don't sing anything I wouldn't be able to sing in front of my pastor. People fall in love, whether you're, at the church or if you're in the club. You do fall in love the same way. The feelings, emotions, the things that it brings from the inside of who you are, it's the same. And I want to be sure that I sing about love and not sex.
Well, let me talk about that with you for a moment, because that's a really fine line, isn't it?
It is, in that I think people blur the lines of what's okay to say. I believe the line is very clear.
Really?
It's very clear.
Even in your CD, this new one that you have, which is Love the Woman, and the photograph of you on the cover, which is, you know, very lovely, but it suggests to me, and I'm not a Bible thumping person at all, but it would suggest to me that there are some churches in America where that picture of you on the cover would be trouble.
Well, I wouldn't wear that to church. That is true. But that really is the bigger struggle for me than anything, is what I wear.
Really?
Absolutely. What I sing is easy.
Why is that?
You can sing about love all day long, have a really pretty voice, and have a sexy, quote-unquote sexy voice, but not sing about sex, and still emote those kind of feelings. But if you don't get to see something, it's different. I don't know what it is exactly, but I've been more pressured to wear sexy things than I have to sing about sexy things.
You comfortable with this?
I am. I'm sure some people aren't, but that's the other thing I have to know, is what is okay for me. Because there are some people who cannot sing R&B music because the Lord told them not to. I know that God put me in this place to stand for Him in this arena.
Do you feel what I feel when you kiss me like that? I'm not sure if it's love, I just know.
In listening to this, and I've listened to it several times, let me put it this way. When you listen to the whole thing, how does it feel to you?
Well, it's one of my favorite things to do, is to listen to my record before it comes out. That's the first thing. Because it's before the judgment calls have come. And I tell you, I enjoy listening to this record so much. And probably because of being away from being a solo artist for a little bit, I think that had something to do with it. But I really like it a lot.
Do you remember the last time we shared a laugh? It seems like forever, 'cause now I hardly ever see a smile. I've never been the fool to think that love don't cost a little pain. I don't think it's supposed to be this hard to get along.
It Ain't Supposed to Be This Way is the song that is the one you hear when you click on your website. Is that because that's the one you guys want to push?
I felt like it was a good balance of the R&B and the jazz connection between both sides. Because I think if we went with First Kiss, which I absolutely love too, it would have lended more to the jazz side of the album. And the R&B crowd might not have come to it with the awareness that it's more R&B stuff on there also.
It seems like forever, 'cause now I hardly ever feel your touch. I've never been a fool to think love don't cost a little pain. But I think it's supposed to be.
Your voice has been compared to a number of others because of your multiple octave range. Minnie Riperton for one, Niecy Williams for another, and I know that you've done covers of both of their songs. But there is another sound that you have that I actually didn't know you had. Nancy Wilson. Guess who I saw today, my dear?
Guess who I saw today, my dear?
It was a challenge because it's Nancy, but because of what it means to do a Nancy Wilson song.
Yeah. Pressure.
Yeah, that's pressure. And actually, I had the best compliment. She heard the song and she came to me and told me how much she really, really liked it. And she was just smiling. She was like, I mean, you nailed it, baby.
Don't say a word. It's like kissing. Don't say a word. Yeah. Boy, don't try denying what fate has shown me.
Ooh. I'm going to switch gears a little bit and talk about Shantae Moore a little more personally, if that's okay with you. Because you, I read a quote of yours, and I want to read it to you and see what you see what you meant by it.
Okay.
Here it is. I think that's what I was put here to do, talk about my own life and my own views. I like to be able to expose my experiences so that people know they are not alone.
Yes.
Do you remember saying that?
Absolutely.
What do you mean?
Well, I've been through a lot. People don't like talking about things that hurt. Usually we like to skip over that stuff because it brings up something that's unpleasant. But honestly, it's the only way that I feel like some of those things have purpose because of somebody else's journey. And I really believe, you know, the quote from the scriptures that says, all things work together for my good. All things work together for my good. Not just the stuff I liked. Not just the stuff that felt really great and the highs in my life that were wonderful. Even not selling records has worked for my good because my ego is not in a place where you can't be in the same room with me and fit. I'm not in the place that when I see an unwed mother at 17 that I go, she probably didn't have no mama that cared about her. I had a mama that cared and I could have been that girl. And because of knowing that it could have been me, when I see them, the empathy in my heart is different than somebody else's who doesn't know what it's like to be that girl who's been manipulated and her innocence stolen from her. It was stolen from me. And I know what that feels like. And you feel by yourself. You feel damaged goods.
Your innocence was stolen from you?
Stolen. Yeah. And it happens to so many women, black, white, yellow, orange, green, whatever it is. We've all been in places where we've been victimized in some kind of way, usually.
Out of respect, I don't want to go there. Out of curiosity, I do. How much are you willing to tell us about how your innocence was stolen from you?
Well, growing up in a Christian family, you would have thought what happened to me would never happen because my mother loved me and she was very much aware of who I am. But I was a very mature little girl. And at 14, I was allowed to have a crush on a man who was 21. And because he was worldly and had money and he'd been in the Navy, you know, and I was like all little girls see older men and we go, oh, my God, he's so cute. Oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. Well, somehow in there, my father wasn't watching. My mother was watching very closely and thought she could handle the situation. And she allowed this relationship to happen. It should not have happened. I should not have been allowed to date a man. It made me have insecurities at an early age that I should never have had. But a man who could manipulate a little girl's mind and her heart, he was allowed to do things he shouldn't have done.
You have daughters?
I have one daughter.
That will not happen to her.
She will not be allowed to do that. She can have the crush because you can't stop a heart from beating. You can't stop them from going, oh, my God, I love him. That's beautiful. But no man's going to walk up in my house and steal my baby. It's not going to happen.
I appreciate the time, and I appreciate your sharing that story with us. Well, I probably shouldn't say welcome back because that sounds like you've been away and gone.
I haven't been away.
You know? But welcome.
Thank you.
With this.
Thank you.
And then I feel like the leaving, baby.
NPR's Tony Cox speaking with Shantae Moore. Moore's new CD is called Love the Woman, and if you want to see the woman and get more of Tony's interview, we videotaped it. Just go to our blog, nprnewsandviews.org. You can also find out what happened when P. Diddy laid claim to a song Shantae recorded, and then a similar version of that same song was written for Jennifer Lopez.
I heard that it was because Puff Daddy walked in and heard my song and said, I want that song. And he was like, yeah, well, that's already taken. You know, we wrote that for Shantae. And he was like, yeah, I want that song.
That's News and Notes. Nicole Childers, Christabel and Ciabuati, and Jeffrey Bennett produce the show. Sasha Woodruff edits, and Kenya Young is our director. Our technical director is Shireen Strausberg. Donald Spaulding is our drive engineer. Our staff includes Tony Cox, Roy Hurst, Jeffrey Gardner, Devin Robbins, and Zachary Slobig. Our interns are Blake Bishton and Ashley Lisney. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. On Monday, we talk to the mother of mega producer Dr. Dre about her new memoir, Long Road Out of Compton. I'm Farai Chidea. This is News and Notes.
Singer-songwriter Nick Acosta's sound is a throwback to the days of funk and soul music. Nika came on to the American music scene in 2001 with the hit singles Like a Feather and Everybody Got Their Something. Now, Nika Costa is back with a new album and a new record label. NPR's Farai Chidea spoke to her about her latest album, Pebble to a Pearl. Farai started off by asking Nika about the album's first track, Stuck to You.
This album, Pebble to a Pearl, I just have to say the lead track totally, it totally gets me. And I hear a little bit of Stevie Wonder's Boogie On Reggae Woman and just the beat. If you stop the Milky Way, if you bop, drink up every day, if you're the town, I'll be the top. Did that inspire you at all? Or?
Oh, sure. You know, I was constantly, I wanted to make a record that brought me back to the music that made me want to make records in the first place. And that was, you know, early Stevie and Rufus and Chaka Khan and Etta James and James Brown. And so I was listening to a lot of that stuff just, you know, for inspiration. And, you know, so and we used a lot of the same kind of instruments and stuff. Like that's a Moog that's making that sound. And obviously, you know, Stevie Wonder used Moogs a lot. So
Moog synthesizer, early synthesizers.
Yeah,
right?
yeah.
Stax, mm-hmm. which is your label, has been reinvigorated and reinvented. And Stax, of course, Isaac Hayes, the late great Isaac Hayes, mm-hmm. was on Stax. And, you know, I've watched the documentary Watt Stax about a million
That's
times.
Amazing.
So how did you end up on the new Stax after being on Virgin Records?
Well, I had gotten off Virgin and then made this record. And while we were mixing this record, I basically formed a record label because I didn't – called Go Funk Yourself Records, which I was just going to put this record out on my own. And, you know, we paid for it all ourselves and had no real plans to get in bed with another label. But Stax, through the grapevine, heard that I was in the studio and really just wanted to hear what we were doing. And they came in and heard it and, you know, just really loved it and really thought that it would, you know, fit really well with, you know, what they were trying to, you know, the kind of artist they wanted on the label. And they were just really aggressive about wanting it, which was lovely. And also they didn't want to change anything about it, which was really great and refreshing. Don't be afraid to live out loud. Never squash who you are. Be proud. Yeah. You're a universal sound. Yes, you are. What you gotta say, say it loud. Baby, don't you act immune. Somebody else feels insecure.
I understand you started recording when you were 7 years old.
Mm-hmm.
What were you recording back then?
Well, I made this record. My dad was doing a concert in Milan, Italy. And at the end of this concert, he said, oh, you know, my daughter's going to come and sing a song for you guys. And da-da-da. It was a full orchestra that he had on stage. And so I sang this song, Out Here My Own, from Fame.
Mm-hmm.
Fame was my favorite movie at the time. And it just kind of became this huge thing over there. And they just she has to do a record and da-da-da. And the next thing I knew, we were in the studio making this record. And then it just got released all over Europe and South America and Israel. And it was just this crazy whirlwind of a crazy childhood.
My goodness. And with your dad working with Frank Sinatra, I'm mm-hmm. sure, you know, what an incredible family legacy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I grew up around some pretty amazing musicians, and I, you know, I think it kind of got in somehow, but it wasn't like, as a kid, I wasn't super aware of who was around and what was going on. It was just kind of my normal, you know, upbringing.
Being surrounded with some of the most creative people in the world was
I
just
know,
your normal
I know.
Upbringing.
It sounds really like I'm playing it down, but, you know, kids...
Of course.
You know, kids are like, eh, whatever, throw me in the pool, you know? Like, they don't really care. But obviously, looking back, it's pretty cool.
When your faith lights the cannon, when your pride is pulling the trigger, when nobody is left standing.
You know, between Like a Feather and now, you have people who have become known for having this soulful funk approach to music, mm-hmm. like Amy Winehouse, mm-hmm. and who are white. Mm-hmm. And let's just be real. You know, there's a black vernacular that you're playing with, and you've never shied away from that. But do you think that now there's more room for people who are white women singers to play with the black vernacular in music and to find fans?
I've always been asked this question, even before Amy Winehouse, it was, oh, now you sound like, Christina Aguilera, or there was that whole kind of blue-eyed kind of soul, whatever movement that was.
Christina's not as funky as you are.
Well, I know. But back then, she was, you know, whatever. She was white, she was riffing, whatever it was. Different kind of thing. And now it's Amy Winehouse and Duffy and, before that it was, you know, Tina Marie, and then it was Dusty Springfield, and, you know, it goes on and on and on. To me, I'm glad that now, actually, I feel a little bit like the audience and radio have kind of caught up to what I've been doing all along, that now they're a bit more open with the success of Amy Winehouse, and that they're a bit more open to this kind of music, you know, that maybe when I was making records, you know, early 2000, they were like, no one is going to listen to this, we're not going to play it, like, you know, no one's going to dig it, da-da-da-da-da. And now it's been proven that people like it if they just get a chance to hear it.
You do have a song that's a bit more sober, though, Bullets in the Sky.
The path of fear will be there to tread.
Are you more hopeful now? I mean, you know, considering that that's in a context of war, do you feel more hopeful about the world than those lyrics would suggest?
Sure. You know, I think with the, you know, with Obama being, nominated, elected, I think it's incredible. It's an amazing time. And I don't think we've felt, and I, you know, have felt hope that anything can make a difference, or that our voices would be heard, or, you know, anything that it was remotely possible. I'm hopeful for sure that, can't get any worse. Is that my last quote of the interview?
That's your last.
Oh,
that's
no.
Your last. You can invent another quote. Let's see.
No.
Okay. Last
one. That can't
one.
Be your last question.
Last one. What's your favorite song on this album?
Oh, okay. Probably right now I'm loving I'd Love to Love You Less, because it's just such a kind of fun song to sing, and it's very tongue in cheek. It's very sassy. And it's basically this kind of ballad where, if you don't listen to the lyrics, you think it's some sentimental love song, but it's really about staying with this useless guy because he's really good in bed.
That's such an improbable
I
scenario.
I personally have never been there. But
yeah, exactly. No, I can't even imagine it.
Well, you can't keep a home.
That was NPR's Farai Tadea speaking with singer-songwriter Nika Costa. Her latest album is Pebble to a Pearl. You can watch video of this interview and a performance by Nika Costa on our blog, nprnewsandviews.org.
Half the time you're on your phone.